This is Karen Brewster, and today is November 4th, 2024. And I'm here with Delia Clark, interviewing her for the Iditarod National Historic Trail Project Jukebox. And we are on Zoom when I am in Fairbanks, Alaska. And Delia, you are in Vermont someplace?
Cassville, Vermont. Yep.
Okay, and where's that?
Cassville is a little village that's part of the town of Woodstock. So we're in the Upper Valley area of Vermont and New Hampshire. If you think about the two states side by side, the middle area that takes both states is called the Upper Valley. Kind of near Hanover, New Hampshire, where Dartmouth College is, or you might have heard of White River Junction, Vermont. Those are the towns near us. If
I've
you're
heard of Woodstock, Vermont, so.
It's not Woodstock, New York, where
No,
the
no, no. I know it's different. Okay, well, thank you for taking the time today. And before we get into the Iditarod Trail itself, just a little bit of background about who you are and where you come from.
Sure, and just tell me really quickly this project, what's the jukebox or what's the project for?
Well, Jukebox is the our online website at the Oral History Program at UAF, where we put up oral history recordings and we do it, you know, project by project. And the Iditarod Trail, the Iditarod Historic Trail Alliance and Judy Bittner, who I know you know, funded this project that they wanted to document some of the organization's early history and the historic trail designation history and how that came about, and talk to some of the early players and how the trail has been managed. And the ITREC program, Iditarod Trail in Every Classroom, has come up as one of the topics, one of their programs, and how that has functioned and how it came about and how it has functioned. And so that's why Judy recommended your name, because of your involvement with the ITREC program. And
Good.
I think I mentioned to you that I've already interviewed Annette Heckert and Louise Wolfline about the ITREC program, sort of from the implementation stage, but you were involved in a different way. And of course, I've interviewed Judy, who talks about everything. So that's sort of the background. So this interview will not only go in our archive at UAF, but onto the jukebox, along with interviews with all these other people from, you know, the people who helped write the first comprehensive management plan, who got the historic designation, who've been involved with the Alliance, BLM trail managers.
Great.
It's the
Well, it
full
sounds like
game.
a great project. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been fun. I've learned a lot, you know. Unfortunately, for many Alaskans, you say Iditarod Trail and they think of the dog race. You know, so I had to educate myself as well that, oh, it's actually, there's more than that. And back in the 80s, they actually did an oral history project on the historic uses of the trail, you know, the miners and the old route and things like that. So there's actually been a lot documented that most people don't know about.
Right, exactly. And I do think most people think of the race. So that was an interesting thing for me as well. Okay, well, let's see. So I was born in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. I'm a sixth generation Vermonter, and have most lived most of my life here, although I've also sort of worked in every New England state. And in the last 20-ish years, my career has been, I have my own business called Confluence, and I work as a contractor or a collaborator or a partner with different public lands all around the country, mostly national parks, but also U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management, and then other small communities. So I divide my time about half and half between facilitating, helping build connections between schools and public lands, national parks, and also things like strategic planning. And then place-based service learning training. So that's what I would put, you know, ITREC in that category of training teachers to be more involved in public lands. And that's really been you know, a focus of mine has been trails. I was originally working, and you probably heard this from Judy and Annette, with the trail to every classroom, TEC, which was the Appalachian Trail. And we were doing a project, and they got funding 1 year to bring in other long distance trails. And so they brought in the Iditarod Trail, who came and watched it and said, yeah, this is great. We want to take this. We want to adapt it to tailor it to Alaska, and we'll take the facilitator too. And so they sort of chose me, and I have been involved in it ever since, and have loved that work. My educational background is in place-based, is in environmental education and environmental interpretation, and so that's been a good fit for me as I've done this kind of work. Is that maybe that's enough about me.
Yeah, where did you go to school to get that background?
My undergraduate was at the University of Vermont, where my mother was a professor, so I was a faculty brat, and I did a self-design major in environmental education and environmental interpretation. And then my master's is from Antioch New England Graduate School, where I focused on environmental education. Basically, it was called an MST, Master of Science Teaching. It doesn't exist anymore. It was a really dumb degree, but it gave me the degree I needed to go out and do the work I've been doing.
Yeah, so it wasn't a dumb degree. It got you to
Well,
develop a career.
it was K-12 science teaching. Nobody hires a kindergarten science teacher. It was just a silly, but anyway, it didn't matter. Yeah, it did help me get this degree, and I met a lot of people who are still my colleagues and friends.
And so you say you were working with the Appalachian Trail. And do you remember the year when the Iditarod folks connected with you?
I do not. I could look it up if you're interested. I could
Oh,
follow
it's
up with some things. I
okay. I'm just trying to figure out how far back this goes.
pretty far. I mean, because we, I'm gonna guess in the 15 to 20 year range, probably, because after they came, we it then took us a year to get it together, and then we did 1 year where we pitched it to various partners. And then we started, and then we've gone now almost 13. So I'm going to go 17 or 18 years ago, something like that, probably.
Okay.
Because we ran, I'm sure that Judy told you, we actively did the iTREC program in person, I think for 10 years. And then we did it another 2 or 3 years virtually during the pandemic. And I think last year was the first year we didn't do it. It's, it really has been something that we've kept going with, against all odds. So that's, yeah, I'd say that's about right.
Okay. And in that, I guess it was maybe in Annette and Louise's interviews, one of them, they mentioned the name Rita Hennessy.
Yeah, Rita, we call her Hurricane Rita. That's her trail name. It has been really active in trails overall. And she was working with the Appalachian Trail Conserve or the Appalachian Trail National Park, National Scenic Trail, for a long time. And she was the one who basically we I was working on a program called Forest for Every Classroom, FEC. And that was an interesting project that brought together two national or federal agencies, the U.S. Forest Service and the National Park Service, the Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historical Park, which is the only national park dedicated to the history of conservation. It's just a few miles from my house. So we had a national park, a national forest, the Green Mountain Finger Lakes National Forest, and then we had a small nonprofit, Shelburne Farms, which is in our area, and a national nonprofit, the World Wildlife Fund. And so we had those four partners, and put together a program called Forest for Every Classroom that was about teaching kids to make decisions about the future, to be engaged in shaping their own communities. And it was a fabulous program that's actually still running. And we expanded that program to around the country. We did it in Montana and Texas and all over the place. And Rita came to that program 1 year and said, "Wow, I'd like to do one of these for trails." And so she adapted FEC into TEC. And then she's the one who got the funding to invite other long distance trails that made it get adapted to iTREC. And along the way, PEC, Park for Every Classroom, also got developed, which was a National Park Service program that brought groups. It was a, run a little differently as opposed to train the teacher. It brought teams that represented a local nonprofit, a national park, and a teacher. And those teams came together and developed teacher professional development. But I've got such a glare here. I'm trying to see if I can get a little less glare. Let's see. Oh, that'll do it. I have this screen that my anti-glare screen that I can use. There's also WEC, Watershed for Every Classroom. So it's a whole sisterhood of programs. And we've done to, one of the things we did together is the iTrek Tech, FEC, and PEC all wrote a manual together. So we each took on different chapters, and the information we felt was important for teachers to have as they went about implementing these programs. And then we tailored them each to our own program. So the manual for iTrek has a little different information, like, for example, the history of the Iditarod and that kind of thing. So it was it became a really exciting and energizing collaboration, taking this model, evaluating it, getting good data on the effectiveness and how to make it even better, and then implementing it in these very different settings.
Well, yeah, it's interesting that there's so many of them. I had no idea that there was this, this underground network
Well, they
of.
all, I mean, that's why I'm sure they mentioned Rita Hennessy. It was really Rita coming to FEC and wanting to adapt it to the Appalachian Trail that then led to the Iditarod Trail. And so it was, sort of a conversation amongst a group of colleagues. And we also we formed this other organization for a while called PEAK, which is Place-Based Education Evaluation Collaborative. So we all, with a couple other programs, chipped in part of our budget to do cross-cutting evaluation into this whole model of place-based service learning to see what, to make sure we were all sort of implementing the same thing and identify where we weren't, and then identify what were the most promising practices emerging from that approach, which was really exciting. It feels as though you're not only doing a thing, but you're doing all you can to do it, continue to do it better. So we learned a lot from that, and there are this many reports written about all of our programs.
So I'm not quite sure I understand your role versus Rita's role at the
Okay.
beginning there.
So Rita was a federal employee, National Park Service employee, and I was essentially a contractor with a nonprofit. So Shelburne Farms had hired me to implement some of the trainings for the Forest Fairy Classroom program. So Forest Fairy Classroom had I helped lead it. Some of the was kind of co-led it some of the early years, and Rita came as a participant, and then said, "Ah, I'm gonna model this, turn this into a thing for trails. Could you help with that?" And I love that. I'm a very trail-oriented person myself. I currently serve on the advisory council for the World Trails Network, and I've served on the Appalachian Trail and other groups. So it was a natural fit for me to be involved in helping to get tech off the ground. The model is a little different from iTrek. In the Trail to Every Classroom or tech model with the Appalachian Trail, we began with so basically we had four times during the year. The Appalachian Trail is really long, well, like the Iditarod Trail, 2,200 miles long, and so we had it was divided at that time into four segments, and so we had teachers meet with other teachers in their segment in the spring, with regional workshops we called them, and then they all came together in the summer with all to get 60. We were doing it's. It's the East Coast, so there are a lot more people too. So we were doing around 60 teachers a year, compared to more like around 15 with iTrek. But so we would ha they'd be at their regional workshops, and then we'd all come together and do a big workshop in West Virginia at the National Conservation Training Center. I don't know if you're familiar with that, NCTC. And then they'd go back and have a fall regional workshop and a winter regional workshop. So it was a kind of different with with because of the travel constraints in Alaska, we decided to do it a little bit differently and started with a great big central week-long workshop. We did it at, I'm sure they told you, at Alyeska at first, which was great. They hosted us so beautifully. People felt like they were, queen for a day, being at such a, fabulous facility. And then we did the fall one in Seward and the winter one or winter spring to close it out in Nome. So we just did three and we kept everybody together the whole time as opposed to dividing them out, which I thought worked super well for Alaska.
So that first year you did it, everybody came to Alyeska. I haven't heard about that first one.
The first when we so we'd already been doing it a bunch of years with the Appalachian Trail, and or if you're from the South, you say Appalachian Trail, a big debate. And so when Jamie Schmidt and I think Annette and one other person, Mona, I think, came to NCTC and watched our week-long summer program for Trail to Every Classroom and said, oh, this is great, we want to bring this to Alaska, got funding. And so then they brought Rita and me to Alaska to sort of pitch it to some potential partners. And that's we had a big partner meeting with the Forest Service and the Historic Trail Alliance and BLM and Campbell Creek Science Center, and maybe Knowles came, I can't remember, some other groups, to see if they'd be interested in doing this in Alaska. And that all kind of took a year, kind of, I mean, by the time we'd sort of gotten it going. So then when we did do the first year, we already were in Alyeska. Yeah, Judy had gotten them to very generously, give us reduced rates and that kind of thing. And we did it at Alyeska, I'm going to go with 5 times, I think. I mean, even more, maybe quite a number of times. And it was a real treat for teachers because it's such a wonderful facility. We'd be in our classroom looking out windows, seeing weddings happening. At one time, there were four weddings in 1 week, that people come there and happen out the window. And we could go to there, it's travelable to some really interesting sites, mining sites, and that kind of thing. So I thought that was great. Maybe we even did it 6 or 7 times there. And then we stopped that and started doing it up in Anchorage, which had the advantage of certainly being more central, but it meant that teachers tended not to stay overnight. And I think there's something that magical that happens when you do overnight programs where people bond over a glass of beer or whatever in the evening, and you can do a little bit of evening programming and then they come back. And we lost that when we started doing it in Anchorage. There were a few staying over, but the bulk of them would just go home in the evenings, which they found easier if they had families, but maybe a little less effective educationally. But in Seward and Nome, we were still doing a 2-day program with 1 or 2 overnights, including travel time, which was good.
Yeah, I've only heard about the Seward and the Nome. As I said, I didn't realize that it used to start out at Alyeska.
Well, it always had starting out with a whole week programming. It just wasn't always at Alyeska, but it
Okay.
was at least 2/3 of, it was for pretty long before we got cut out of that.
Why place-based learning? Why environmental education?
Is this for me personally, or for why we think it's important for Alaskan teachers, or?
Yeah, and why? Well, let's start with why is it important in general? Why is this something that
Maybe I'll start because I do see your question as how I personally got interested in environmental education. When I was a high school student, I did a Knowles course, National Outdoor Leadership School, in Lander, Wyoming, which was a huge deal for me. I'm a little Vermonter kid, and I'm the oldest in my family, so first time leaving home, it was a big deal. My parents were, very much doubting the wisdom of the whole thing. And that got me very interested in environmental education. As I mentioned, I designed my own major in that, and then did a bunch of all of my work in my career was looking at different angles of that. I ran a nature preschool program in Connecticut that got 52, 3 and 4 year olds out, learning about the natural world. I ran a business leaders program in Norwich, Vermont that brought together business leaders to learn about the environmental aspects of the issues that they were facing and sort of an educational program for them and a chance to rub elbows with each other, and kind of everything in between. My husband and I co-directed a wildlife refuge in Rhode Island, a Norman Bird Sanctuary that had a lot of educational programming. And so I was doing that kind of work, and it I just was very convinced that building people's affinity or affection for the natural world turns them into people who then want to care for it. The same way when you have friendships or your family members, as you develop an affinity for them, you then want to care for them. And so I was a pretty big believer in that. And the whole idea of not scaring kids, don't tell them all about terrible disasters first. Let them just get friendly with squirrels, or whatever it is, and then they can get see where that goes. So I one of my colleagues, David Sobel, has written a number of books about that approach, and I was a kind of a convert to his way of thinking that you give immersive experiences in the environmental world to little kids, and then as they get older, they can begin to understand some of the structure of that, and then as they even get older, they can begin to do something about it. And so, place-based service learning is the idea that it's grounded in your place and your community. You've got community resources coming into the school, maybe as presenters or people or whatever, and you've got kids out in the community identifying issues that really matter to them and their families, so their parents begin to think this is important as well. And then also the idea that they identify something that could happen and they do a project about it. So there's a boat landing where people are putting their boats into the river, and it's got a great big signboard with no signs on it, just ripped up, shredded, BB, bullet holes, whatever. And could we fix that up and make it into something that would give useful information about invasive species to take off the bottom of your boat before you pull your boat out, or here's some really cool things to look for. You might see a nest, or trying to. So that's something that kids can do that will really make the world a better place. Trying to find appropriate level of projects that are inspiring for kids, that they can talk with their parents about at home, and that aren't just kids as window dressing, that aren't just we're going to send kids out to go pick up litter and then we're going to take pictures of it and put it in the paper. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about kids learning about something, identifying a real issue or question, and then figuring out a possible solution, and then going out and implementing that solution, where it's appropriate at an age appropriate level.
Well, you say certainly it builds ownership in place, which you feel ownership in a project and in place, you're going to keep doing it and protecting it and loving that place.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's exactly it. And I think that placemaking skills are important no matter where you live. So, kids growing up these days, wherever they're growing up, are not that likely to live their whole life in that place. We're a very mobile society. I mean, they might, and if you're lucky, maybe they come back to raise their own kids later. But I think that the ability to learn about a place, to learn about the not only the natural world of that place, but also the cultural of that place, the cultural heritage and social norms, and to really understand how a community, the politics, understand how a community functions, is something you then can take with you when you move or wherever you go. So I think that those become lifelong skills for kids. And there's been some really interesting research that Rita Hennessy used to always quote that showed that the Appalachian Trail, I don't know how familiar you are with it, but it's a big long trail. It has, last I knew, this might not be quite accurate, but it had 9 federal employees for 2,200 miles of trail. And the way it's managed is by this thing called the Cooperative Management System. So there are 32-ish clubs that manage each a section all up and down the trail. And those clubs are pretty much all volunteer organizations. So essentially, you've got this major, significant national, United States National Park being managed by volunteers. It's kind of crazy to even think it could happen. And the way that it happens is, by through this whole structure and these cooperative management system, what that relies on is people who want to be volunteers and get out on trails with chainsaws and whatever, and do all the other things, write, lick envelopes and whatever. So it's been interesting. What, the quote Rita would have is that if you're trying to rise up a generation of people who still want to volunteer and not just, be glued to their phones and their screens, then the most effective way to do that is to give kids volunteer experiences. That what they found is that kids who volunteer are much more likely to be volunteers when they're adults, because they've sort of, seen that happen. And so it's that so it's and not just volunteer, but to be active in their communities. So place-based service learning is based on that model of very early on, even, in kindergarten or first grade, there's something they can do at their local little level to make the world a better place. Maybe it's on their school grounds. It's, and again, not window dressing, something that they understand and agree with, but that gives them that chance to experiment. And I mean, the idea is that that's also supporting their learning. So they're also there are math skills or social studies learning or language arts skills that are related to whatever the thing is they're doing.
Yeah, because I usually think of, environmental education, place-based learning as, you go out and you learn the plants, or you look at the insects, or follow animal tracks in the snow, or something sort of more natural history maybe based. This idea of then doing a service project, I think that's a component that I never really heard about before iTrek.
Yeah, I think that sort of old school, not to no shade on your, but I think when people used to talk about environmental education, they talked about natural history, natural environment, natural history, geography. And I think when you look at place-based learning or place-based service learning, you're pulling in history, heritage, culture, you're pulling in the arts, aesthetic appreciation of the environment, you're pulling in civics and government and political knowledge and social studies and geography. So it's a much more holistic look at the whole community with environment and ecology as a central part of it as well. But it's understanding the place as a whole. And then the service learning part of it is that idea of giving kids opportunities to act on what they're learning.
Yeah,
An environmental education, I'm sorry, my whole, I designed my whole major in environmental education. I'm a big believer. I just think that it's evolved into this field of place-based learning that takes it to the next level.
that's very interesting. So let's, I'm gonna say that, just so the idea of how you use a 2,000-mile trail as a place of place-based learning. How do you do that?
I mean, obviously, it looks really different with the Iditarod Trail from what it looks like with the Appalachian Trail. I mean, the Appalachian Trail goes from Georgia to Maine right up the eastern seaboard. You can pretty much not walk, except for the top, the 100-mile wilderness at the top. Pretty much every 2 days, you're going to run into a town. Really different on the Iditarod Trail, where some of it is actually only goes over frozen rivers. It's only a trail at some parts of the year. There, you can't even walk it all. You can walk some parts, but not all. So I think that what we were trying to do with iTrek is to work not just with schools on the road system, Anchorage and all, but to also work with rural villages where we could. I mean, obviously, it becomes really expensive when you've got to fly teachers to Anchorage, even to fly them back up to Nome. They can't fly from where they are to Nome, all that kind of thing. It's a so it's it, the costs are higher, but the the opportunities are astounding, for the kind of work that we're talking about, where they're in villages and they're working with elders on berry picking and hunting and engaging kids and things that, have a really strong cultural heritage and are meaningful to the elders in the community as well as to the kids. There's just such cool stuff you can do. So I think when you ask how you do it, partly it's a question of people understanding, the history of the trail, and that it's not, as you said, not just a race. It's, understanding the whole story and how it was formed and where it goes. And then for kids, as a, I think that it makes much more sense to learn about the here and the now than, the long ago or the future. I think kids like tangible things. So if there's a way that they can look at a specific piece of trail that's near them and do a little project, for example, making a guidebook to the plants of that little section of the trail near them. Or a bunch of schools made scale models of the Iditarod Trail in their school parking lot, and they would sort of walk it, or if you read this many books, you get to advance that far or whatever. I'm sure you've probably heard about projects that weren't even, well, if, so for example, in Seward, they might have told you one of our signature projects that happened early on and was such a so inspiring for other teachers was there was a teacher who just basically wanted to get her kids outside. She was a fifth grade teacher and she was looking for some way to get her kids outside. So she said, okay, we're going to go out to the creek near the school and just do some water testing. She didn't have any grand plan in mind, called Shuffler Creek. And she took her kids out there. Have you tell me, stop me if you've already heard this story. You
No, go
probably
ahead.
have. Took her kids out there. And her kids were like, ew, this smells icky. This isn't us. And she said, ah, teachable moment, and had looked into what it was that was smelling so bad. And it turned out that this creek was called Fish Ditch within the city limits of Seward, because it's where all the offal, when they caught fish, they would put all the fish guts and stuff. And it was pretty polluted and pretty gross, even though it was considered a world-class salmon stream upstream. And so she thought, let's ride this out and see what we can do. And the kids ended up doing these amazing things. They did all kinds of water quality testing. They looked up the maps and found out that the name literally changed at the city lines. They found out that there was a lot of degradation of the stream bank and that kind of thing. They convened a meeting of all the grown-ups in town who could do something about it. I think 17 adults came. They're like, well, the kids asked us, so we couldn't say no. And the kids greeted them and had little scripts that they read to them, and ended up over a 2-year period getting multiple things happened. They got the town, their city, it's a city of Seward, right? I believe, council to vote to rename from Fish Ditch to Shuffler Creek, I think it is. They passed some legislation protecting what could happen in it, because all of a sudden it had this designation now as a salmon creek. And then they got a grant. I kind of say it was $45,000. I might be wrong on that number, but I think so, to do native plantings all along the stream bank to protect it. And so and the kids did art projects showing some of the species that they'd seen in the creek. And so they made a rotating art exhibit that went from both the municipal building to the school library. It moved around town a little bit, and it was just this great success of the kids making actual real change in their community just through their curiosity about why does it smell bad. So that's not linked directly to the Iditarod Trail, but obviously Mile Zero is right there and you could walk there from school. And so I think it was our intention was not that all the projects would be related to the Iditarod Trail. It was It was doing some kind of relevant place-based service learning project in your community, based on, for the, what you, they would learn about the Iditarod Trail, and then they would see if they could find a project that made sense, and it didn't have to do with the trail. Yeah, so it was a teacher education program inspired by the Iditarod Trail.
Well, and the fact that it was in Seward, which is a community very much connected to the trail. So
Very much.
that's the connection you make there.
Oh, another teacher in Seward did the coolest project. She made, she did a quest, so an installed treasure hunt of all of the murals of Seward. I don't know if you've been down there lately, but
Yeah.
they're beautiful art murals all around town. It was so a lot of people doing different kinds of projects that are cool. But
Well, yeah, that's interesting because as I say, I hear about it and I think, oh, it all has to be trail related. But I guess it doesn't.
We no. We I mean we felt that we were trying to change teacher practice. So our goal was more to create a cohort each year of Alaskan teachers who were teaching in this different way, teaching, in using place-based education and using the Iditarod Trail as kind of a hook to get them interested, because they're, obviously if you're an Alaskan teacher, but also something that they could do projects related to the trail, but we really thought it was more important that they do whatever made sense to their kids and to them.
And so,
So
why teach the teachers? Why didn't your programs just bring kids in and you that you did it through
the
teachers?
obvious reason that you can just reach so many more people when you teach teachers, and this is a teacher professional development model. So there are lots of million wonderful different ways to work with schools. But the FEC family, I call it, or whatever, the FEC, TEC, iTREC, PEC, and WEC programs are all teacher, well, actually all except PEC are teacher professional development model programs, with the idea that you've got this amplification. You teach one teacher and then they teach whatever, 20 students, and then by 5 years out they've taught 100 students, and that kind of thing. And as I said, the PEC program was a little bit different in that we were trying to create teams that would be a nonprofit organization, a federal land agency person, and a teacher working together. So a little different.
Yeah. And you mentioned some of the teachers from the villages. Of course, for many of us, the Iditarod Trail is only, Anchorage to
Oh,
know. And
yeah.
most of those are rural communities. And so, what was the level of involvement from those teachers?
We had some wonderful, wonderful, lucky, good case studies working through some of the villages. As you know, I'm sure the trail alternates years. So it goes through different villages depending. I'm thinking, for example, of Holy Cross, where we had a teacher who, there were a couple of teachers who did some really great work. It's a it's I and I'm sure you know this, and I shouldn't be, I mean, this is not my area of expertise at all, but I understand that one of the challenges is that often you have white teachers teaching native kids. It's a, they and trying to do a grow your own program of encouraging more native people to become teachers and be back in their communities teaching is really important thing to do. So we did have some native teachers in the iTREC program, and we had, for example, one teacher who was married to a native guy, so she was a white woman. So there, it's a, but it, because place-based education is so grounded in the culture and the values of the community, it doesn't make quite as much sense if you're someone who's just come in, you do it for 2 years till you burn out and go. So you want people who are going to be more integrated into the community over time, and there are some, there are plenty who make that move and are going to stay, and or who are from there. And we had one teacher who was an aide, but was she's a native woman who was an aide who was getting her teacher certificate while she was going through the program. So that certification. So that's a great thing that can happen too, I think.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say is that in many villages, unfortunately, the teacher retention rate is low. That they say they stay for a year or two and leave, and how that affects your program with ITRA.
Yeah, I mean, that's a, you put your, hit the nail on the head. It's certainly an issue. And I think that we've tried to, I mean, we've had mixed results. We've had some teachers who were gonna stay, like married to a village, someone from the village, and obviously they're raising their kids there and everything. Or had gone there with their family and intended this was the life they'd chosen for themselves and wanted to stay there. And then we had others. Another kind of success was teachers who taught at the village level and then took the ideas and went somewhere else on the road system. So I think it, you hope that you're gradually spreading ideas across Alaska. And then you also have teachers who think it's great and then they leave the state. So, but that's, there's nothing you can do about that. You're sort of trying to build a movement. So it is competitive to get into the program. And so we would try to look for teachers that were interested in really implementing it, not just a free trip to Anchorage or whatever, and teachers who had strong administrative support. That was another factor that we tried to weigh in, so that they were going to be supported when they went to implement it.
So strong support from their school administration or their school district.
We would ask for a letter from the principal saying, yes, I'm gonna, because they're gonna be having to miss some school to go to the sessions, and they're gonna be trying to implement something, not radical, but innovative, and they're gonna need some support to do that, and maybe even financial support. So trying to make sure that that gets, that's gonna happen. Those are the main things.
What did you do in terms of recruitment of teachers? You said it was competitive, but how did teachers know about it, especially out in the villages?
Send out lots of notifications through school districts, and tried to get district the science coordinators for the districts to know about it and to promote it with teachers. Tried to get alumni to go back and get some of their collaborators to come and do it again. At one point we had had every single, this is I'm sure no longer current, but at one point every teacher in Girdwood had been part of the program because partly because we were there in Alyeska, but it's pretty exciting, that they would, that they just kept, if you were like one of two teachers that hadn't done it, then that was a bummer. Same thing with Seward. We had a lot of Seward teachers going through, and working through the agencies. Annette probably Annette was doing the bulk of the recruitment, and she probably talked about that as well, getting agencies to go out and put out the word. And Campbell Creek Science Center, which does a lot of outreach, Louisa, if you spoke to her, would also, spread the word. So word of mouth and sending out brochures, and I think the point of making the application, not odious, but or onerous, but it wasn't nothing. You had to write a couple essays and get this letter of support, was to really make sure that people were pretty committed to it, because we do, what we covered was their transportation, although if they weren't in driving range. So if they were, for example, in Anchorage and could drive themselves to Seward, we didn't cover that cost, but we helped them find carpool mates and that kind of thing. But we did cover everybody's flights up to Nome. Judy is so talented at getting Alaska Air to give donations and that kind of thing. She's also great at getting everybody a window seat. I don't know how she does it on the Denali side of the plane. It's always amazing. She thinks it through. So that, so, and then we would, I think once they'd applied or written their applications, it was a sign that they were really committed. We
And
weren't
did they have to
hurrying
have a
anyway.
did they have to have a project idea in mind when they applied, or that came after they were doing the workshops?
Yeah, we actually evolved that as we went along. They didn't have to have a project idea in mind. The idea was they would develop it at that during the summer and bring kind of a draft ready to go to the fall meeting and then bring a final report to the spring meeting up in Nome. But over time, we shifted. We felt that teachers were focusing way too much on the project and not enough really on sort of place-based teaching. So the last few years, instead of doing a project, we had them do a shift in teacher practice. So they had to identify some place-based service learning teacher practice that they wanted to work on, like getting kids outside the school more, or like building more partnerships, or following kids' sense of agency, you know, get let helping kids to feel that they had a voice in shaping their own education, or one of the principles of place-based service learning. And then they would identify which one they were going to do. They'd talk about how they were going to do it, and they'd sort of report as they went along. It was definitely squishier in terms of, you know, really tracking what people were doing, but arguably more effective in terms of really longer term change and that kind of thing. The projects just became like, people get really nervous and upset about them. It'd be kind of a lot. So, but on the other hand, we got some really cool projects out of it. So, and a lot of them had heard about other teachers' projects, so they assumed that's what they were going to be doing, and wasn't always.
So your role, when you got involved, you were the trainer.
I was considered the lead trainer, but and facilitator. So I'd be sort of the glue that would be saying, okay, time for a break. We'll be, you know, that all of that kind of thing. And the lead content, you know, it's my area of content expertise. So I was the SME, I guess they call them, subject matter expert. But Annette and Louisa and others all would do lead sessions as well. And Judy.
So you developed the original curriculum?
It's together, we took the tech curriculum and adapted it or tailored it to Alaska. So a lot of it was, I mean, some, you know, we brought in as presenters, Dan Seavey came a bunch of years, which is really fun. And I'm forgetting his other person.
Lee Pulaski.
Lee Pulaski. Yeah, so great. Just love those guys. And they would come and do, you know, do obviously a session and that kind of thing. So we took the as I said, the tech curriculum, the tech principles of place-based service learning and all that kind of thing, and then adapted it. So one of the first year, I think it was, Dan actually brought his dogs. It was really cool out in the parking lot, and people got to see. And but Lee did a beautiful job of doing this that I think ultimately became a PowerPoint of him with his voice, you know, explaining it. They would get a big kick every year. We would have the same joke. I think it's Balto. There's another famous dog. I'm pretty sure it's Balto's stuffed and in a museum in Shelburne, Vermont, my hometown. So they would always, you know, make jokes at how I'd stolen their dog and that stuff. But I'd never seen him there. But I, you know, I think. It's there were other people on the his I did on Historic Trail Alliance board who were involved in different ways up in Nome and that kind of thing. So trying to sort of pull in resources where we could. It's different from a set curriculum. So iTrek has a curriculum, but it's not it doesn't it's not a lesson plan. So essentially, teachers are creating their own lesson plans. That's the whole program gives teachers a chance to develop. We figure teachers are experts in teaching and they're experts in their kids. And we're providing them with some a little bit of content and then a lot of sort of technique or approach. And then they're designing their own lessons. So it's different from what you might think of Project Learning Tree or another sort of canned curriculum.
So, how did you adapt it to Alaska? You hadn't been to Alaska perhaps yet when you started this.
I actually had been a good bit because I was working with Denali on their strategic planning and community planning things. But No, I didn't know anything about it. I mean, so I just because I'd been didn't mean I could do it. So what I knew about was place-based education or place-based service learning. And the agency partners, Annette and Louisa and Judy, they knew Alaska. So together we kind of co-created what would work.
Question. So you how long you've continued to be involved with iTrack since the beginning? You've been the facilitator every year?
I was back when we first did the partner building workshop, and then all the times I was involved as the sort of lead facilitator, and then pandemic happened, and they pulled me in to continue to be faculty on some. We did something called Take It Outside, I think was the name of it. I should fact check that, but which was a series of virtual trainings that we offered to teachers that they could sign up for. And then we did a course for ADSDA, Anchorage School District Summer Academy, ASDSA, ASDSA. And we did that either 2 or 3 years. So going through their summer academy program and offering an iTrack unit. So basically, when we couldn't do in-person learning anymore, we kept trying to do it in the virtual setting. But whoo, teachers, can only do so many webinars. Anybody can only do so many webinars. You just burn out. And also the requirements changed, at least within the Anchorage School District, for what amount of teacher professional development they have to have, and so it stopped, and funding changed and all these things, so it stopped being as feasible to do in-person trainings. We were not getting the enrollment that we were looking for, and we also budget things, so we are, and then this year happened. So I think what I'm currently involved in is I have a little contract to try to write up, document the full model in terms of how we did it and resources, bibliography, sample agendas and all that kind of thing, and plans for the future. We did. I was there a year ago, almost in January. And we brought together some iTrek alum. And had a really exciting conversation with them about they mostly have all now gone on to be principals and things like that. So had an exciting conversation about what they'd gotten out of iTrek and where they'd like to, where they thought it could go in the current context, in the current setting within how things were with the state of Alaska, how things were in the Anchorage School District and all that kind of thing, what they thought would be good future directions. And so we've documented all that, and I'm going to add that to this report that I'm writing.
So, what were their feelings about what they got out of it?
I was afraid you were going to ask that. Oops. I have all these notes, but off the top of my head, huge, big thing was sense of agency, of their real belief in themselves, to make a difference, to the belief in their own teaching skills and that kind of thing. They hadn't been treated. They felt like they were really being treated like professionals, who knew stuff. They weren't, and that was really empowering. They loved the connection to the trail. They'd all been part of having Dan and Lee come and all that kind of thing. So, they loved that kind of stuff. But I think they felt that the support that one the biggest thing probably was the community of practice. So bringing together a community of relatively like-minded teachers who could support one another it over the across a year, since it was a year-long commitment, from July all the way through till end of April, mid-April, that or May actually, by the time they handed it in. So they had, I guess, 9 months of continual contact with each other through, coming together and social media, and we did a series of calls in between, you know, the in-person gatherings. So they just loved meeting teachers from that they wouldn't have met otherwise from outside their school, and sharing ideas and that kind of thing. So I think that you could call it community of practice or community of learning was really rich for them.
Did they reflect on how they felt it worked for their students?
Trying to remember if anybody specifically, I mean, I got the idea really well, you know, because they were enthusiastic about it enough to come to this follow-up meeting. So I think they must have thought, but you might have been told that Hannah, I think her last name's Brewster. So Hannah Brewster, pretty sure, did a master's dissertation or master's thesis on iTrack. And she interviewed a whole lot of teacher participants and principals and others about, and it's a gold mine of quotes and things like that about exactly what you're asking, you know, what did kids get out of it and that kind of thing.
And do you know through what university that was?
Think it was UAA,
Okay.
but let me double check.
Because I can find it.
Yeah, let me, I think I have a.
Be a good thing to link to
Oh,
from
absolutely. It definitely
that.
would be. Yeah, let me just see if I quickly have it. If you don't mind. Let's see here. Be harder than I thought. Okay. I'll try to send it to you as a follow-up.
Okay.
I thought.
I was just thinking too about the virtual meetings during the pandemic versus doing it in person, how that may have changed things.
Yeah, I'm just looking at this. So it looks to me like so we did it 10 times in person, 10 years from 2010 to 2020. The April one in 2020 we had to cut off, and then we did it virtual for 3 years from 2020, 2021, and 22, and then we kept going with the USDSA and then the rep. So it's been, yeah. It changed it hugely. I think it was a lot less effective because I think that, as I just said, one of the most impactful parts was creating a community of practice. So when they were together and they had, you know, like I said, time in the evenings to go for a walk or go out for dinner or whatever, they, you know, that makes such a difference. And they just weren't getting to know other people really in the same way through this. You know, for attending these some webinars and things like that. I think the content was still good. I feel like the content that we put together, I think some of it was excellent. You know, we took turns doing each of us doing different ones, and they were all recorded. I think they're all available on YouTube. You know, I think that was good, but it's not, I think what it in addition to not having the community of practice, they also just didn't have the personal support. So, you know, we were doing one-on-one calls with them during the time and being available to answer questions and, you know, just sort of a lot of, it was a lot of coaching and mentoring and, you know, visiting each other's sites where they could. So it's a lot that doesn't happen once it becomes just a virtual
Yeah.
course. But
Well,
like I said, I thought we did a pretty good job with what we had, and
I think that group dynamic and brainstorming and being together in the same location makes a big difference.
yeah, it really does, and doing it over the course of a year, so that they, you know, they know that, you know, if in July that they're going to be seeing these people still in November and again in April, and going to exciting places. Nome is a pretty cool place to go if you haven't been. It's, you
Right.
know, well, it's just a crazy place. And I think that was a that sense of kind of excitement made it different from just taking a couple after school webinars.
Well, I don't know, how do you face the challenge of, you know, teachers these days are so overloaded and overworked and not enough hours in their day to do everything that they want to or need to do. and certainly not properly compensated. So how do you face that challenge with getting teachers to do something like this, which is out of their, normal practice and time?
Yeah, I think that's a question that we're having right now. And, it's become a non, it, we're not gonna do it this year because of all of the cuts that have come down from Washington. But I think that there was very strong interest, these teachers that we talked met with last January, very strong interest in keeping it going. And so, we brainstormed then ideas of what this could look like. And I think there are a bunch of ways to do it. We've always offered six, for the 10 years we did it, we offered six graduate credits through UAA, and that was good for them. They, I think that they needed a certain number of credits to continue to, keep up their degree and stuff. But we talked about maybe if that's too much, we could offer 3 1-credit courses, for example, and you could only take the later ones if you'd already taken the earlier ones, so they'd be cumulative in that way. That might be more palatable. Or I mean, we sort of brainstormed, I think, 8 different models of things that could look like that would make sense in this more this kind of contemporary setting. And things may change, but
But were you faced with those challenges through those other 10, 12 years?
no, we really weren't. I think that people found it. I mean, we never had, we would get about how many applicants we had slots. And 1 year we only had 9 people. It was a smaller year. But mostly we would, it sort of worked out pretty evenly that we had the number of applicants of slots we had. And I think they just were so excited to, they're teachers, they're kind of, high quality teachers who want to up their game, who want to do things that they think are going to be exciting for kids, who want to be able to, see kids' eyes light up when they learn about this wonderful stuff. So that because they have this certain level of excellence, it's they're eager to have these kinds of opportunities. And, travel's fun. It's fun to go to Seward. It's fun to go to Nome, and it was very fun to go to Alyeska and get a chocolate on your pillow every night. But it's not how most of us get to live. I think we also it got a really good reputation. So people, it was pretty easy to attract people because they would already have heard about it from, a colleague or their friend's colleague's friend or whoever. So,
Yeah, but
but
finding the time to leave your classroom for a week in the
well,
middle of the school
the
year.
week is in the summer. So
Oh,
the
okay.
yeah, the week was in the summer, and so they were only having to get subs for 2 Fridays usually, depending on how far they were traveling from. Sometimes a Thursday and a Friday, but so it wasn't so hard, and that was what the teacher the this principal. Commitment would be for. The principal's letter of commitment would have said, yes, I'm going to support them getting a sub. But, subs aren't free. Not only they cost money, but the teacher has to leave behind work. It's a lot of prep and that kind of thing. But I think summer is also a time when a lot of Alaskans, do might go away or something like that. So it was, it's never easy to find time, but we would try to put it out there early enough that they could sign on and make it fun enough sounding, some fun evening activities, hikes and things like that.
We've talked a little bit, this is one of them, the challenges, other challenges you may have had, or some weakness in the program that you think could have been improved upon.
I think we struggled to get village teachers from off the road system, partly because of, as you're saying, the turnover in those schools, and partly often there's only one teacher or 2 teachers in the school, so for them to be gone for a Thursday or Thursday Friday is a much bigger deal, and maybe even not be back by the Monday, depending on how the flights work and stuff. So we would be we tried. One of our solutions to that we never did, an idea we always had, was to go and do the teacher in-service day for something like burying Bering Strait School District or something like that. BSSD. So that we could get all the teachers at once, or that, because I do think we always were so struck by how perfect this approach is for those rural schools. I think, well, I don't know what, because we sort of switched, we pivoted during the pandemic and haven't done the in-person sessions since. We tried to do one and didn't get enrollment. And I think that I think we are not current on what, the realities that you're talking about in terms of just time and competing pressures, and also the lack of need for teachers to get the same kind of certification. So I think if we were to start up again, we would need to make sure that this model works, in Alaska now. It certainly, I think the 10 years we did it, it worked great. It was, we had amazing feedback, very positive, and all, strong enrollment every year, and all that kind of thing. I just think that it's that times have been changing, and it would be, we would need to kind of reevaluate. I very much still believe in the model. I think we might need to tweak it in some ways to make it work for people's lives. But
In all those discussions in those eight models, was any of it focused on how to address this village teacher issue?
first of all, I want to say that I made up the number eight. It was a lot. I'm not sure it was exactly eight, just so you know. And yeah, I mean, Camel Creek Science Center has got a lot of contacts in rural Alaska, and it goes and does, programs there and stuff. Almost always when we would go do iTrek in Nome, they would be doing something with the Nome school too, just to make it worth the flight and stuff. So I think that they had some ideas about how we might continue to do this. But Louisa was a key part of our team, who was part of our team since the very beginning, and has since retired. And so I think it'll take a new kind of onboarding of someone else to see, what that could look like. Judy has a lot of thoughts about how to work with rural schools, and a bunch of her board members do. So we've had a lot of conversations, but I don't think we've quite hit the answer yet. As I said, I think I already said this. I just do think that where I live in Vermont and in New England, place-based service learning, and in a lot of the Appalachian Trail communities, is perfect for rural communities. It just is such a good fit in terms of using what's available locally and getting kids excited about bonding to their place and that kind of thing. I've done it in urban communities as well. We've done a bunch in Boston, for example, but and Anchorage. But I think it is it you know it's it'd be great to think about making it work.
Well, and as you s gave the example, and that's how I think of place-based learning is, okay, the local plants, and then we do a guide, or we talk to the elders about how we, butcher a seal, and then they demonstrate. That all to me makes total sense as place-based learning. How you connect that with the Iditarod Trail is the part that is a little bit harder to understand.
Yeah, I mean, I think our, as I said, our mission wasn't, there is this teacher on the trail that the race does. We're not that. We're a different thing that's about trying to do place-based service learning with the trail at the center and as a hook, but no obligation to do
Right.
it. Yeah.
What the teacher on the trail, is that they ride in the sled or no? What's the
I think I don't know exactly. They know they choose one person every year. It has to do with letters. I think they are do have some visibility, like maybe being in the sled at the what's that start called? The ceremonial start. But I think then they spend the whole year, I think, doing, I don't know what, actually not very familiar with it. We did have them call us up and ask us. The person who coordinated it once interviewed me for an hour, and we talked about how to collaborate, but it's a little vague in my mind.
Okay. So what has been the greatest reward for you for working on the iTrek project?
I just love how excited teachers get. I mean, they just are so excited. You know, if you think about that, you've been, you choose to be a teacher probably because you really believe in it, right? And then you get there, and it turns out that there are all these constraints and politics and limitations and testing. And I find that this approach just, it's like, this is why I became a teacher, you know, and they, it's just so exciting. I think that's been really rich. I mean, for me personally, it's been a wonderful, you know, just as on a personal level, opportunity to learn more about Alaska. You know, I've been to Nome 10 times, and that's not a thing I would ever have done. And I made a quest up in Nome that was really fun to, you know, installed treasure hunt that. So I learned a lot about the history of Nome doing that. I think it's also been really compelling for me to, because I was the lead teacher in TEC, the Trail Every Classroom, and I've also been very involved in PEC, Park for Every Classroom, is no longer going. That program has just stopped, right? But anyway, I think that it's just been really compelling to see that the model can be so relevant in these different settings, and how, you know, how you don't, it's not a canned curriculum by any means. It's very much tailored to each place, and that's just exciting to see happen. You know, I love working with great people who also are real idealistic and have these big beliefs. I've really loved the iTrek team, and in fact, we're all gonna get together in Arizona this winter just because we're so used to traveling together. We thought it'd be fun to go to the desert for a few days. So that'll be really fun.
Great. And again, you've sort of talked about some of the challenges, or were there frustrations for you personally?
I don't think, I mean, nothing's really coming to mind. I feel as though the style of iTrek suits my style. I mean, Judy's amazing nurturer, so that, you know, we start out, I mean, all those early years where we start out in Alyeska getting, you know, fancy food, and then by the end she's bringing like jars of peanut butter, and you know, and everyone's making their own sandwiches. I mean, she just, you know, the fact that kind of making it work and DIY and all that, it's been just such a great fit. I think, and you know, no, I mean, I feel as though I wish that we maybe could have, that, I mean, we made the manual. It took a little longer than I thought. I mean, so, but I don't know, you know, it went well. There are always personality things with some teachers that you just are like, but that's going to happen anywhere, right? So, yeah, I'm sorry. It's
No,
not
because I was
to be
just,
evasive. I really can't come up with anything.
well, no, I was thinking about, you know, we've talked about the challenges that the program faced. So it was like, well, what about for you personally and getting it off the ground, and were there sort of some of those challenges and frustrations for you as an individual?
You know, I'm just not coming up with anything. I've loved it. It's been a really, really rewarding chunk of work for me. I'm not being coy. I just can't think of what it
Oh,
is.
well, that's fine. I just
I
couldn't balance all the good with, you know.
mean, it's hard. It's, you know, all the things. It's red eye from Anchorage to Vermont is a long chunk of travel, and being away from my kids, and you know, there's all the stuff that goes, but my work has always involved travel, so yeah.
Well, looking back, were there things you think you and or the program could have done differently? Or that you wished things you wished you could have done?
I maybe that is a thing, a frustration for me, is not being up there. I couldn't implement ideas I had because they were reliant on my other team members to do them, and you can only ask people so much to do your idea. And so I think, I mean, I do wish we had been more successful at getting into the villages, and or the you know, I don't know what you the communities off the
Right.
road area. I think that would have, and we tried a few times and we just weren't getting it. So I think that is one thing. Wait, what would you say, challenge? Remind me how you phrased the question.
don't even know how I phrased the question. Missed, if you could have done things
Oh,
differently,
done things differently. Yeah.
or there were things you wished the program could have done.
I mean, that would be one. I was unhappy that when we moved the week-long course to Anchorage, teachers chose to stay at home because I knew how powerful an experience it was for them to have that time together and bond. And it meant that it took us longer to create those bonds, really all the way to Seward, before, you know, to the fall, before they were beginning to go, oh, these are a great group of people, I should get to know better. And, you know, it was, they were just kind of coming in from whatever, 8 to 4. And so I think, but I understood, you know, you can't really ask people to be away from their families in the summer if they, if there's no reason for it. And we were offering them dorms at UAA. It wasn't like, you know, hotshot accommodations. And so, but I did feel that made it kind of frustrating.
And in those times, so most of those teachers then were from Anchorage or the Matsu Borough.
Well, yeah,
They could go home every night.
the majority, and then some teachers came in. So I would stay in the dorm, and there'd be one or two teachers also staying in the dorm, you know, that had come in from we had teachers from Nome most years, and we would, I think most years we had someone come in from one of the rural communities. Not every year. Oh, you know, another thing I think I wish we could have done better is more strongly connect with the na native corporations, maybe, or native communities. I think that what the approach we're doing, for example, resonated really well with the Cherokee communities in North Carolina, and I think that it resonated well with native communities in Alaska, and we just didn't get to do it enough. I think we weren't quite breaking through the barrier of attracting native teachers. And as I said, we had a few, and that went well where we did, but that would have been something I wish that we could have, we might just not have not quite had the right contacts or something like that. But I think that the content would have been there. I think they would have welcomed it from everything I've read and know about Alaska Native culture and values. You know, again, I'm projecting some of this, but I think that this whole idea of connecting to the land, to community, to elders, to heritage, you know, that I think that stuff, and finding ways for kids to help make the community a better place and to want to stay. That's all. I feel like it's all very resonant with what I know about
Well,
Alaska.
the part about connecting to the land and your culture and your elders' heritage, that is already going on in those communities and those
Yeah.
households and cultures, native cultures. So yeah, it's just the
Maybe they didn't need
surface
this. Yeah.
and also that's what I was thinking too about some of those
Well, but
villages.
linking it to the school, that it's the
Yeah.
service part, as you're saying, and I think creating it ways to link it to the curriculum that maybe
Yeah.
isn't happening as much.
Well, and in some places, I think it is. But I was thinking about, some of those villages where the current Iditarod Trail goes through their community and the race goes through their community, creating a sense of stewardship of the trail and ownership, to me, that would fit perfectly.
Just a minute. I just need to quick send a quick text.
But so and maybe that's already being done in those villages. I mean, I know when the dog teams come through for the races, the whole village goes out, and kids get super excited. Now, whether it's integrated into their classroom stuff, I have no idea.
Yeah. I mean, I know in Nome, we, you know, as I said, we did a lot of work in Nome, and it wasn't as much. I mean, I think it was, you know, they would do some sort of, I don't know, I would call it window dressing type stuff. But in terms of, for example, one teacher did a wonderful project one year where the kids created a pamphlet to introduce all those tourists that were coming up to Nome and all those racers to Nome. It's like, we're, let you know, you've just gotten here, let us teach you about our community. And that was really cool, I thought, you know, to sort of to how can the kids do, you know, something the kids could do that would actually have a big impact. So yeah.
Yeah, and I was thinking, those villages along the trail create a sense of ownership and stewardship to help protect the trail and maybe help keep it maintained and all those things, or get signs out or whatever. That, as you say, that's the whole thing of place-based learning, is you create a group of people who love the place and want to help protect it.
Exactly. Over time, and I think that is right. So.
So hopefully that can happen more in the future. Well, I think we've sort of covered everything. What do you think?
I thank you so much for making the time to do this. I think it was a really high value program, and I think it's a compelling model, and I hope it gets picked up again when times change.
Yeah, well, hopefully. And again, I'd never even heard of it until working on this project, but I'm not a teacher, so I don't know. But it does sound like it's pretty fun. But again, a lot of work for teachers to implement these
What
things.
I found with all of the programs I've done, and in addition to the ECK ones I talked about, I've also spent a lot of years doing this one called CoSEED, Community School Environmental Education Program, that we did all over the place. And what I found is that teachers, it definitely is more work, but it's work that they tend to want to do, because they don't really want to just hand out worksheets. They want to see education that's effective. And they've got a lot of pressures. They've got to meet these test scores and all this kind of stuff. And what we've felt we've had to demonstrate with these models is, this is, yeah, test scores, we got that, check, 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 and we're also doing this other stuff. So it's not just about making it's not being fun or getting kids out in the community. It's about meeting all of the educational objectives and doing it in a way that also helps kids become effective citizens in the future and know more and have placemaking skills and all that kind of stuff. So teachers who are excited about being a teacher want to take that kind of stuff on. And not everybody does, or maybe it's not their year. Sometimes, maybe it's not your class. It's some. We also didn't say they had to implement their project that year. They could be designing something that they'd do the next year if they had a challenging class or something. So it's really about over time shifting, giving teachers the tools they need to teach the way that they wanted to when they first became teachers. So.
And the funding for this came from the Bureau of Land Management.
Primarily also the US Forest Service. And then with the other programs, we've had private grants, as well as for the Park Service. So it wasn't only federal funding. So we had with tech, we had a number of different private funders as well.
Yeah, because I know that, for iTrack, it comes through the Alliance, but I think they get some of their funding from BLM.
Mostly they get it.
So, yeah, getting it back up and running, hopefully that will happen in the future.
I hope so. In whatever form makes sense at that time. I don't think you'd want to ever take it cookie cutter and do the same thing again, but I think what I'm trying to do is document what we did and how it went and what we learned, so that someone can go, wow, here's something I could adapt to my times and to my, so hopefully it'll be a, something they can tailor.
Well, that you just said it, like what we learned. So do you have a way you can summarize what you've learned?
I think the community of practice is essential. I think giving teachers an opportunity to get together with other teachers outside their school, who are thinking about the same things they're thinking about, is so many teachers can get really siloed and isolated. And I think that that's really important. I think treating teachers like professionals, treating them, that I remember I was in not in one of these, but in a different program, and we hosted it at a place that had a pool, and there was a bar near the pool, and it was after hours, and this teacher is in the pool with this little drink, with a little umbrella in her drink, going, "What is it about this that doesn't feel like normal teacher professional development?" I mean, I just think oftentimes teachers get undervalued. so valuing them, not just how you treat them, but what everything they know, and not trying to tell them how to teach, just telling giving them resources so they can do what they're already doing, you know, in some different thought-provoking ways. And then I just think authenticity, authentic connection to the landscape, to community, to, you know, culture and history, you know, so that it's you're really doing that. Oh, I would say a fourth thing is partners, to that to really take advantage of the opportunity to partner with not only, I mean, in Alaska, federal agencies where you have more, but you know, other nonprofits, historical societies, you know, other museums, other groups that might want to be partnering with schools, but they kind of don't know how, or they can't find their way in. So that helping to create, you know, vibrant partners. One of the things we used to do in iTrek every year was speed dating. Someone might have mentioned that, where we'd have a group of, we'd invite in partners, and we'd have the teachers rotate in a table and get sort of 10 minutes with each one to talk about what their needs were and what project might make sense and that kind of thing. So that would be another. And then I guess if I were going to say a fifth thing, I would say youth voice or student voice, that we've really learned the importance of not just telling kids what they're going to do, but actually letting kids have an appropriate, age-appropriate level of say in whatever it is. You know, it's not like they're going to invent a whole project, but they might invent the part that has to do with their age level and skill level, and get to say no if they don't want to do it. So I think
Right.
that's what I learned.
Well, great. Thank you. That's a great way to tie it all together and
Good.
summarize
Well, thank
it,
you.
unless there's anything else that I have not asked you about.
Nothing that comes to mind. If you think of anything, feel free to call.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I know you're really busy.